of opioids. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
8:10, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD sports and weather. Packers lose to Detroit 30-17 up at Lambeau on Monday Night Football. The NBA, Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Both teams back into action tonight. Both teams on the road. Bucks meet the Cavaliers in Cleveland. The Bulls play in Toronto. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, November 7th. Cloudy for the morning hours, sunny for the afternoon, a high of 43. Clear and cold tonight, a low of 22. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, sunny and 45. Pretty good cloud cover, but there are some breaks of sunshine this morning. 35 degrees Racine, 34 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. There's no question but that for many people, one of the biggest checks they ever write in their life is for a college education. And it is a huge cost. It is painful to pay for just about anybody unless you are extraordinarily rich. It is a very significant investment, but of course one that can pay off so very, very handsomely in all kinds of different ways. But the matter of paying for college is a not insignificant challenge. A new book has just been published that is designed to be a very practical guide to paying for college and giving all kinds of different ideas on how paying for college can be a bit more, let's say, possible and a bit more painless than it might otherwise be. The author of the book, the author of the complete guide to paying for college, is Leah Ingram, who is also known as the confident spender. She dispenses all kinds of helpful advice on financial matters to ordinary people. She does that at parade.com, in magazines like Good Housekeeping. You've perhaps seen her on television on any number of occasions. She's actually the author of 15 books. This latest one, published by Career Press, again, is called The Complete Guide to Paying for College. And Leah Ingram, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. And I might say that, yes, paying for college is a big expense, but so is buying a house. So, but we can talk about that in another interview.
Right. Yeah, that's another steep challenge. We should say that you come at this particular topic not only professionally but personally, that this has been a reality for you and your husband, who have two daughters born 23 months apart. So you know more than a little bit just from your own personal experience about what kind of a challenge this can be.
That is absolutely accurate. I talk about in the book how when my daughters Jane and Annie were born in 1995 and 1997, respectively, my husband and I did this crazy college math that determined that if we wanted to fully fund their college 529 savings plans, which of course we set up when they were born, we had to put aside $2,200 a month for the next 18 years. And as a young couple, we just turned 30. We were early in our careers with a first house, you know, a mortgage, student loans of our own to pay. It was just unattainable. So I wrote this book because I feel like our middle class family represents so many middle class families. And without putting a number on a salary to define middle class, this is how I define it. Basically, we have never earned enough to fully fund a college 529 savings plan. We make too much now to qualify for traditional need-based aid, but we don't earn enough to pay for college out of pocket. So we are in that proverbial rock and a financial hard place. And that is why I wrote The Complete Guide to Paying for College, so I could present to people, first of all, hey, totally know what you're going through. Secondly, let me talk to you about some ways you may want to think about paying for college that nobody has ever talked to you about.
So you in writing this book, are, in a sense, combining the professional and the personal. I mean, combining a lot of things that you already knew in the work that you do with people, combined with what you, in a sense, the new stuff you had to learn as you were suddenly confronted by this challenge in your own life.
That's 100% correct. And I also want to add that some of the advice that I offer on paying for college is a little controversial, and I've gotten some pushback from it. That's because one of the methods that we used, and we used a patchwork quilt of methods to pay for college, was taking private loans. And one of the chapters in The Complete Guide to Paying for College is talking about how to get your financial house in order and improve your credit score so that if you find yourself needing to make up some difference in that tuition bill that scholarships or grants or federal loans didn't cover, you can apply for a student loan if that's what you choose to do and get an optimal interest rate because you have a good credit score.
So you are exploring various options, and some are going to be applicable to some people and others perhaps not. And it sort of underscores the complexity of this challenge and the fact that one size does not fit all.
One size definitely does not fit all. And, you know, I just think it's so important for parents to look at all the options. And, you know, I think there's commercials on TV now that talk about, you know, like that advice was never made for you. Like when people are sharing advice, you know, well, this is what I did. Sometimes what I did might not be right for you. So, for example, you know, if all the people in your school district or many of the families in your school district say, well, I'm going to send my kid to the state college because the state college is the cheapest, that might be true, but it might not be true. And one of the things that I stress in the book is this notion of don't get hung up on the sticker price of a college. What you have to figure out is what is your real cost of attending and what is the final price. It's kind of like buying a car where, you know, you go to the lot and you see the sticker price, but if you've done your research, you know, maybe you went to Consumer Reports and you figured out, well, no, they actually spent X for this car. So you haggle, you negotiate, and you finally come to a final price that is probably not the sticker price. College is very much the same as that. You may not have the same haggling success, but the price that you see listed on the website, chances are that is not the price that you will end up paying.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Leah Ingram, and she is the author of The Complete Guide to Paying for College. And it explores this intriguing challenge and issue from a lot of different perspectives. One thing I appreciate about your book is that you lay a considerable foundation of kind of background, including the fundamental question of is college worth it? And a number of provocative articles have been written in recent years that, in a sense, call this into question. That have people asking, well, is it really worth shelling out all of this money? Do I really get something of comparable worth or even greater worth in return for such an outlay of hard-earned money. So you pose that question, and you really answer it pretty decisively. I don't think you're quite saying everybody should be going to college, but I think you're suggesting that for many, many, many people, the benefits of a college education are very significant, and some of those benefits are even sort of beyond the obvious.
That's 100% true, that I do not say that every person should go to college. I know that there are plenty of technical fields and other non-four-year degree fields where people can be incredibly successful and never get a bachelor's degree. But those are unique situations. In the book, I actually cite a Georgetown University study that says that 65% of all jobs in the economy by 2020 will require a post-secondary education and training beyond high school. I also talk about this notion of lifetime earnings. Those that are coming out of college are going to earn significantly more over their lifetime than those who only get an associate's degree at a community college or those who simply have a high school degree. Now, the intangible benefits that you sort of touched on are things like communication, the ability to write, working within a team setting, dealing with difficult situations, learning to live with people who are not like you, not from your background. These are all the intangibles that come from going to college, and you really can't put a price tag on that.
I was actually struck in some of the information you gave in this section of the book at the unemployment rates that you gave. That is, you told us what essentially the national unemployment rate is right now, but then you broke it down according to those who have a college degree versus those who had a limited experience at college, to those who are high school graduates, to those who just did some high school and failed to graduate. And as people's level of education goes down, the unemployment rate goes up. And I had never seen statistics exactly like that before, but that seems like a pretty inescapable reality in terms of the difference that a college degree makes in terms of one being employable in this modern economy.
I appreciate that you brought that up, and I do need to add the caveat that the numbers in the book were current from the Bureau of Labor Statistics when the book was finished in February of this year. So what is that, 6 months have passed, a little bit more than that. So the numbers could be different, but you're right. You know, when you look at the overall unemployment rate, sounds pretty good. Numbers are pretty low, pretty happy about that. But then when you break it down, it really is kind of mind-boggling that twice as many people with a high school diploma are unemployed versus those with a bachelor's degree, and it's almost three times the number for those who never finished high school. So, yes, that in and of itself is a great reason to get a college degree or at least get an associate's degree, because it's I'm going to go all medical on you, but it's kind of like getting an immunization. You know, if you get a vaccine, you're less likely to get sick from something. And it's almost like getting a college degree immunizes you to some degree against being unemployed. And boy, I hope that's, you know, continues to be true.
Right. And you spell out in this section, of course, also some good advice on people essentially putting their own financial matters in good order, and some basic tips on cost cutting, which of course is something all of us should do a better job of, but particularly anybody who is facing the challenge of wanting to put one or more of their children through college, and other good general advice, and some other matters, including the matter of a young person securing college credits before they ever set foot on a college campus. I mean, before they are even done with high school, having sort of a head start on getting those credits towards college graduation. Just how big a difference can that make in terms of the ultimate price tag for a college education?
So many people think about earning college credits before high school graduation as a way to cut the amount of time that they spend in college. And that could happen. So let's say that you enter college with enough college credits to be a second semester freshman instead of a first semester freshman. Logic would dictate that 4 years later, you could graduate in December and save a whole semester of housing, room and board, and of course, tuition. But let me flip that a little bit and talk about something that people don't talk about. And that is the biggest hidden expense of a college education is the fifth year. And that's because there are so many students who don't graduate in 4 years. They go for that fifth year, and many financial aid packages only go for 4 years. So suddenly you're paying full freight for that fifth year of college. And I'm going to use my daughter Annie as an example of how earning those college credits before high school graduation can help you avoid that fifth year. So my daughter Annie earned the equivalent of about 19 college credits through the advanced placement or AP classes that she took in high school. She goes to college, she gets there, she has been admitted to the arts and sciences college at her school, and she realizes halfway through freshman year, she doesn't want to be in the arts and sciences. She wants to be in engineering. And that requires not only changing a major, but changing a school. Luckily, the school that she attends, it's very easy to do that. But here's where those AP credits helped her. In order to change the major, she should have taken a bunch of prerequisites her first semester freshman year. So now she wants to change a major. We're worried that she's now going to be behind, which will then push her into that fifth year. Luckily, the AP classes that she took and the scores that she received helped her to fulfill those prerequisites without actually taking those classes at college. She was able to change majors, and she is on track now to graduate on time in May of 2019. So that's another way of looking at earning those college credits and saving money in a way that most people don't think about.
Right. In the second portion of your book, when it comes time to actually apply for colleges and explore financial aid and so on, the real nitty-gritty of the process, you point out a number of things, including the fact that the costs of just applying to colleges can really pile up when on top of it you include matters like having your SATs or ACT results sent off to all these different colleges that, at least under certain circumstances, there can be cost attached to each one of those transactions as well. It's probably important that people are aware that even something like just the application process involves an expense, and people need to be prepared for that and careful about assessing just what kind of cost we're talking about.
So in the Complete Guide to Paying for College, I do have a section which is one of my favorites, which is how to apply to college for free. And it addresses this notion of application fees and fees to have test scores sent to the college. And while there's probably no way of getting around having the SATs and the ACT fees sent, although the caveat to that is if you put down the colleges when you take the test, sending it to the college is free, but you don't get to see what your score is when it's sent, so I don't recommend that. So yeah, there is a way to send it for free. But anyway, what I was going to say was there are ways that you can apply to college for free. So I have a section in the book that lists colleges that don't charge application fees. I talk about months where in North Carolina and Virginia, students can apply to college for free during a certain time period. If you go on a college tour or a college comes to visit your high school, you can often get an application fee waiver. And all of this sort of goes back to earlier in the book where I talk about cost cutting at home and whatnot. You know, if you cannot make applying to college free for you, you know, go back to the cost cutting tips that I saved, and you could free up the money that you need to apply for college so that the actual process of applying doesn't put you in a financial bind.
Hmm. One of the important points you make in terms of financial aid itself in your long section that addresses a number of frequently asked questions is the fact that the application for financial aid needs to happen at the same time that people are applying to college. That is not something that occurs months later, because if it occurs months later, then you're really way too late and unlikely to get anything close to the result that you would want. Is that correct?
So what you're talking about is applying for financial aid as a freshman applicant. So you're submitting your applications to colleges likely in the fall. Sometimes it can go into January. However, there is a federal student aid form called the FAFSA, and that is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which is, yes, for federal student aid, but most colleges in the United States use it as a way to determine what financial aid they're going to offer you. The FAFSA opens every year now on October 1st. This is the second year that it has opened in October. October. Previously, it had opened in January, but we don't have to talk about the past. We want to talk about the present. So you have to fill this stuff out if you want your student to qualify for financial aid, and especially if you're applying early. So November 1st was one of the first early decision deadlines. There will probably be an early action deadline at many colleges on November 15th. So now is the time to do it so that if and when you get that application, you know, yes, big thumbs up in December or January or maybe even later into 2018, they have all the information that they need for you to get that financial aid. And there's two other things, important points that I want to make, and I do outline in the Complete Guide to Paying for College. One is, while the FAFSA is sort of the gold standard, it's not the only form that you may need to fill out. So many private colleges use something called the CSS profile, and then many colleges also require you to fill out their own financial aid form. So that's three forms that you need to fill out. And you have to do this every year that your child is in college. Financial aid is not a one and done. So this is something that you will have to do every year. The second point I wanted to make, which is super important, is many times colleges are first come, first served with financial aid. And this is especially true with schools that have something called rolling admissions. So they don't have a strict "we'll let you know by" date. It's basically the earlier you apply, the sooner you hear. And in these kinds of rolling admissions situations, there is a set pool of financial aid. And once it's gone, it's gone.
One thing you touch on briefly that's intriguing is the notion that someone might be tempted to, in a sense, deplete their own financial well-being or financial status for the sake, then, of being eligible for more financial aid. I think the real-world example that you cite in the book is the notion that someone might actually choose to sell their house so they don't own this big house and not somehow appear wealthier than they are. Or that would be a case in which someone's money is tied up in something. It's not actually money in your pocket that you can shell out for an education. And so in some ways, some might think that it would make sense to do that. I think you say that, in fact, that kind of thing, at least that specific instance, is not a good idea. And does anything even resembling that ever make sense?
You know, I know that this is one of the Q&As in the book, and I literally have the book in front of me, and I'm flipping through trying to find, but I'm pretty sure the takeaway from that was the money has to end up somewhere. And so, you know, if you have liquid capital, it's probably in your bank account. And one of the things you have to do when you fill out the FAFSA is tell them how much is in your bank account. With the CSS profile, you have to let them know how much is in your retirement account. So I'm just going to say there is no legal way to get around applying for financial aid. And I kind of just want to leave it at that. You know, you have to be honest. The FAFSA uses something called the IRS retrieval form, which basically inputs your data directly from your last tax return. So I don't recommend cheating the system. I don't recommend trying to cheat the system. I just think that too many people think, well, there must be a way around this. And you know what? There isn't. The one way to legally get around this is not to hide your assets, but instead have your child apply to a school that is slightly below his or her academic profile. And what do I mean by that? If you go to any college admissions website and you look on the web page for admissions, they will often give you the stats on the previous year's incoming class. What were their SAT scores? What were their GPAs? Yada, yada, yada. Look at those numbers, compare them where your child stands, and this is where the secret sauce comes in. So schools that are looking to up their academic profile will throw merit aid, so that's free scholarships, to attract kids with good grades to go to school there. That is one of the best ways to get the most financial aid. Forget the Ivies, forget the elite, you know, small liberal arts schools in New England or the Midwest. They're not giving merit aid. There's no merit aid. The only people who get aid are people who have need, financial need. If you want to get the most merit aid, you want to look at colleges, look at their academic profile, and target the ones that are below where your son or daughter is, and you will significantly increase your chances of getting that free merit aid.
A last question. What is the general climate now versus, say, 20 or 25 years ago in terms of the cost of college versus the amount of help that is available? I mean, is this a relatively good moment in time in terms of college being potentially affordable?
I can't really answer the affordable part. I'm not an economist, so I don't even want to venture to guess on that. But what I can tell you is demographically, the pool of college age students is shrinking. So, you know, the baby boomlet is over. The millennials have all grown up and gone to college. So what that means is fewer students are applying to college, which means many colleges are having a harder time making their freshman class. So I think that now may actually be a better time than 20 years ago to get financial aid because you're competing with fewer students.
On that note, we leave it to our listeners to seek out your book, which is The Complete Guide to Paying for College, published by Career Press. The author, Leah Ingram. Leah Ingram, this has been fun. Thank you so much for joining me on The Morning Show.
Great. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. Anybody who cares about our public schools needs to be listening for the next few minutes to this interview and then getting a book called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And I say that really everybody needs to see this book because whether or not you share the grave concerns of this book's author, Diane Ravitch, or if you are someone who fervently believes that that choice and school testing are actually laudable attempts to improve our educational system, this book will really give you a lot to think about. And it traces the history of how these things have come into being, these practices, and some of the consequences of them, and that shares the really intriguing story of Diane Ravitch's own journey and of the changing opinion which she has held about these matters. She has a long career in the world of education. She is research professor of education at New York University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and actually served in the early 90s as assistant secretary of education in the administration of the first President Bush, and also served in official capacity during the term of Bill Clinton, the editor or author of a number of different books. And this latest one, again called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, is published by Basic Books. And Diane Ravitch, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
One of the most intriguing things about your particular story and the way you begin this book is around the whole notion of changing one's mind and of doing so openly and gladly without a trace of embarrassment. And as I think you rightly point out, so often in modern America, we view the someone changing their mind on a really crucial matter as some sort of sign of weakness, when in fact you describe that in very, very different terms, in some ways exactly opposite terms. Talk for a moment just about the concept of changing one's opinion in the public eye.
Well, you know, it wasn't hard for me to do this. It took a few years. I had been very engaged ever since I served in the first Bush administration. I became persuaded that choice was promising, that accountability would provide the information we need to improve schools. And over time, as I was involved with various conservative think tanks at the Hoover Institution, also the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation in Washington, both of these on the right side of the political spectrum. And I was very much part of the conversation about choice and accountability. But over time, I started watching the results and thought, it's not working. Accountability is actually narrowing the curriculum. It's turned into a very punitive dialogue about how many schools are going to be closed, how many teachers should be fired, and how swiftly can people be punished. And this somehow was so at odds with what education is about. Education should be about improvement and supporting and developing and helping people grow and helping teachers get better, helping students do better. And the whole help and support and improve rhetoric disappeared and got replaced by failing and firing and punishing, and it just didn't seem right. And then as I saw the results come in, particularly the national test, and I had served on the National Testing Board during the Clinton administration for 7 years, and I thought, you know, all of these policies were leading us nowhere. There were very, very meager results from No Child Left Behind, and in terms of reading, there were almost no results. The eighth grade reading scores over the past decade have been fundamentally unchanged. And then on the choice topic, I was hopeful about choice, and I thought, you know, the more good schools, wherever they come from, that's great. But then I saw what turned out, which was choice schools, charter schools, a whole sector in the vouchers producing no improvement, especially in the voucher area, no improvement, and Milwaukee ground zero for no improvement.
but in the charter sector, this very wide variety, from excellent schools to abysmal schools. But again, on the whole, no improvement over regular public schools. So I ask myself, do I really want to see the public school system dismantled and have it taken over by private sector entrepreneurs? And no, I didn't. So it seemed to me, because I've written so much and so widely over many years, that I needed to go on the record about this, because this country is plunging headlong in exactly the direction that I concluded was the wrong direction. And so I'm right now kind of out there, not quite alone, but almost alone, saying we're heading in the wrong direction, wrong track, stop.
There probably are not a whole lot of people who are exactly in your position, that is, people who championed some of these reforms and now have grave misgivings about them. I mean, as opposed to people who right from the start did not like the idea of any of this. But what I'm curious about, among other things, is did you find yourself at all in a difficult position in terms of stepping before a microphone or setting down in print for the reading public, essentially the words, "I was wrong about this"?
Well, you know, in a way, I had to kind of get right with my conscience. And I think what was hardest was that I had many friends with whom I had been in strong agreement, where I could step forward and either of us could say the same words. And I guess that what I've discovered, and I guess all of us have discovered, is the country is very polarized. You're either on the left or the right, you're blue or you're red, and then people listen to radio stations and watch television shows that reinforce their views, and they don't hear opposing views very often, or they hear them in a context where they'll quickly be refuted. And so I was stepping outside that particular paradigm, and it meant that I was also breaking with some friends and very close associates, and I didn't persuade them. But I had to, in effect, what I had to do was to get right with my own conscience and my own sense of what was right and wrong. And I had to tell what I thought was, the story. The story is I was wrong. I wish that I'd been smart enough to see these things 10 years ago, but then maybe no one would have listened to me.
Right.
If I'd been saying these things all along, then people would say, oh, yeah, we've heard that before. But it's because I know the arguments on both sides so well, and particularly on the right side of the spectrum. I was part of those discussions for many years. I've heard everybody, the most brilliant minds in the country on the right, I've heard their views, and I concluded that they're wrong, and I have to say so.
Hmm. You write at one point, doubt and skepticism are signs of rationality. It is doubt that shows we are still thinking, still
right,
willing to reexamine hardened beliefs when confronted with new facts and new evidence. One of the things that you think is perhaps the single biggest mistake made in all of this is something that you call a false analogy drawn between education and business, drawn, in your words, by corporate reformers with a very weak understanding of what education is about. Talk a moment about this false analogy between education and business, how it came about, I mean, why people found themselves drawn to that model and why it has ultimately played out so badly.
Well, we have now something that's called an education reform movement that is really driven not by educators, and hardly has an educator in its ranks, but it's led, first of all, by the big foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Eli Broad Foundation, and a bunch of other very, very wealthy billionaire foundations, and they think they have all the answers. They are joined with corporate executives and some school leaders who are not educators, like Joel Klein and others who have either a background in business or law. But their fundamental focus is education should be more like a business. It should be competitive. We should have a kind of, put schools together, let them compete for students. Let's have a private sector mentality. But that's not the way schools work. Schools work more like, I'd say, almost like a family. When a school works well, it has a culture where this people in it collaborate. They don't compete with each other for bonuses. They sit down and they say, how are we going to help Johnny and Maria? How are we going to turn around this child? This child doesn't want to come to school. He's unmotivated. how are we going to help Maria? She's having trouble reading. She's having trouble in science. And they share. They don't have trade secrets that they keep from each other. They sit down and they work together. The minute you start introducing bonuses and tying teachers' pay to test scores, you destroy the collaboration. It turns out after I finished the book, I started reading Edward Deming, who's the great guru of quality in business, and he also is opposed to paying bonuses to people who are in the same job. He says that it doesn't work in business either. He says that it destroys the morale of the corporation and of the whole enterprise when you get people focused on their bonus and they then forget the goals of the organization and just focus on the bonus. That's what happens in education as well. People start focusing only on test scores, on very low-level basic skills tests, and they forget the other things that are important, which are working together to help kids, which is the common enterprise of the school.
One of the things that one of the pictures you paint is that this is a way in which some people who maybe genuinely want our schools to be improved, and particularly for low-performing schools to improve. This was a way to do that, but a misguided way. I mean, do you, at least by and large, accept the sincerity of these efforts, or are there other factors that are driving this movement more than a genuine concern for how well our young people are educated?
I believe that the people who start charters are, for the most part, very well-intended. They're mostly young people who want us to work in education and to do the right thing for low-performing kids. But the most successful models in the charter sector are completely not sustainable in terms of transferring them over to public education. For instance, the more successful charter schools have a model where they bring in young college graduates from elite institutions like Teach for America, and then work them 60, 70, 80 hours a week. Well, that's not sustainable. We can't have a teacher workforce of over 3 million people and expect them that they're going to work those kinds of hours. It just that's fine if you're 22 and 23, but at some point you want to have a family, and the schools that operate on that model have a tremendous teacher turnover. The teachers leave after 2 or 3 or 4 years, and they have to start all over again. So it's a way of deprofessionalizing education, and I don't question the sincerity of the people involved. I just think that it's not a model that's going to help improve American public education.
If there is an abiding message in page after page of your book, it is this. You write it towards the very beginning of the book, throughout the book, and towards the end. In my writings, I have consistently warned that in education, there are no shortcuts, no utopias, and no silver bullets, no single answer to education improvement. And, of course, that's what a lot of people are just desperately wanting or hoping for, is that there is such a thing out there. If there isn't a simple answer to educational improvement, then what kind of an answer are we looking at?
I think we should have in this country, and I wish it would come from the national level, but it's not, because the Obama administration is actually doing the same things as the George W. Bush administration. They have adopted through the race to the top and their general approach to education, this policy of testing, accountability, and choice, which is the Republican agenda, unfortunately. What we really need is long-term planning where we do what other high-performing countries have done. Not other. We're not a high-performing country compared to places like Finland, Korea, Japan. What these countries have done is engaged in long-term planning where they look at the quality of the teacher workforce, not to fire people and punish them, but to begin to build a high-quality workforce through having high standards for admission and then having mentoring and support for teachers when they enter the profession, making teaching more professional, not less so, having very high-quality principals who are themselves master teachers. We're going in exactly the opposite direction. More and more states and cities are hiring, creating programs called How to Be a Leader, and then they bring in someone who's taught for a year or two, and poof, they're a principal after a year's study. That's not how you develop great principals, and we need great principals. We should also have superintendents who are themselves experienced educators who can make good decisions about curriculum, instruction, personnel. These are big issues, and we don't want to turn them over to lawyers and businessmen. mean, I think we need to have a more professional approach to education. We need to have better tests. Our tests are lousy. We're training kids to guess amongst four bubbles. This turns out not to be a very valuable skill. Nobody hires people to guess among bubbles. What we need is tests that really actually measure comprehension, thinking skills, the ability to solve problems. We don't have those tests now. So we're moving in the wrong direction, and that's what's sad. We're actually adopting policies that no high-performing country has adopted, which is testing, punishment, and that's not going to make education better. It's going to make it worse. We're ignoring history and civics and literature, geography, foreign languages, the arts. This is what makes for an educated person, not just basic skills. So our country is in, I think at this point, our education system is in dire peril because we are moving towards policies that will actually harm education, not improve it.
You talk about how curriculum matters a great deal as well, and you outlined for us some really important and significant missteps when it has come to reforming curriculum or enforcing standards on what the curriculum should include. How would you have reformers of education view the matter of curriculum?
Well, you know, people don't really understand what curriculum is. Curriculum is what are kids going to learn? This is like a very important, this is a very important issue in education that is totally ignored today. We have people running school systems who don't even understand or don't care about what kids learn. All they care about are test scores and data. And the data are just representation of how kids are doing in basic skills. If all we're aiming for is basic skills, that's all we're going to get, and we'll have an uneducated population. So I would urge that we, whether it's at the national level, the state level, or the district level, focus on what are we doing to teach kids history beginning in kindergarten and first grade. And I actually worked on a history curriculum for the state of California many years ago where little kids are learning biographies and stories about long ago, true stories about men and women who changed the world. That's how you begin the teaching of history. You carry it all the way through American history and world history. We should do the same in civics and in literature and the arts. All of these things are important as part of education. And the more we focus on testing and accountability, the more we incentivize teachers to ignore everything but basic skills, and the more we will produce an uneducated population. And I think that's a tragedy.
Are you confident about this reexamination of public education, in fact, occurring? And if so, from what does your confidence spring?
No, I'm not confident. I'm actually confident that we're heading in the wrong direction, that President Obama and Secretary Duncan are firmly planted in the footsteps of George W. Bush and Margaret Spellings, that they're taking the country in a direction that will dumb us down. And I'm trying to ring as many alarm bells as I can to plead with them to reconsider their course. And I would suggest just as a first step, but I'm going to say I've been traveling across the country, and I have to tell you, wherever I go, teachers are demoralized. They're discouraged. They feel that their profession is being dismantled before their eyes and that everything that represents creativity and thinking on their part is being discouraged. And what I'm going to urge wherever I go is let's stop the high-stakes testing. This is where everything gets distorted, is putting all this punishment and incentivize, you know, bonuses, punishment and bonuses, where teachers' salaries are tied to test scores and teachers' lives and their fate are tied to test scores. This is ridiculous. This is a system that encourages cheating, gaming the system, does nothing to improve education, and this is exactly where the Obama administration's race to the top is pushing the country. So as I travel around the country from Boston to Chicago to California, what I tell people is just say no. Don't apply for race to the top funds. It will only damage your state education system. Of course, so far, I can't say that I've had as much impact as I would like to, so I'm not encouraged that they're listening, but I'm ringing that bell and raising alarms as much as I can.
The book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, published by Basic Books. Diane Ravitch, I appreciate you joining me today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And tomorrow on the morning show, in a change from what was previously announced, I'll be speaking with Dr. James Ripley, Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage, and composer James Stevenson, who is going to be the guest conductor for this weekend's Lakeside Band Festival on the campus of Carthage. On Thursday, I look forward to the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And we remind you that